From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is off today.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get right to Washington. There's that planned vote in the Senate on whether to even take up debate on their health care bill. The House is expected to vote on increased sanctions against Russia. The ongoing investigation into Russian interference in last year's election continues apace. And following a headline-making speech to the Boy Scouts of America last night, President Trump will hold a rally in Youngstown, Ohio, tonight. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. He joins us now. Domenico, so much. So let's get right to the Senate.
So much.
Senators were expected to vote on whether to even take up debate. But we're hearing many don't even know what's in this health bill. Do they have the votes?
Well, there's no bill to speak of at this point.
Yeah.
So, you know, what they're voting on is a motion to proceed, which would allow them to move on to a debate. So what that means, though, behind the scenes is that Mitch McConnell has been doing a lot of maneuvering to kind of keep this health care bill alive, or at least a shell of something to be able to work on. So an MTP is what a lot of people refer to it as, a motion to proceed. It's more like a motion to pause, you know, a motion to kind of give you some space so that they can then figure it out. And, you know, what Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate today, alleged on the floor was that really this is a, quote, ruse by McConnell to give them some time so that they can work on something in conference with the House and merge something together. And, you know, there's probably a lot of truth to Republicans wanting to be able to come together because they know that they don't have necessarily the votes for two standalone bills that can then be merged.
Yeah. Okay. Well, wait to see what happens there. Meanwhile, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, last night at that Boy Scout Jamboree, when President Trump introduced cabinet members who'd been scouts, the most decorated Eagle Scout in his administration, Jeff Sessions was not there. Some are saying that's like when Sean Spicer, the most devout Catholic, didn't get to see the Pope. Today, President Trump tweeted, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has taken a very weak position on Hillary Clinton crimes. Of course, investigations into her emails have been exhausted. Can Jeff Sessions stay in that job?
Well, first, I want to pause for a second and just correct the record a little bit. I wouldn't say Jeff Sessions is the most decorated. He is one of several Eagle Scouts in Trump's orbit. I mean, including, by the way, Rex Tillerson, who's the Secretary of State, who had a bronze statue unveiled of him because he's the past Boy Scouts of America president. Ryan Zinke, who's the Interior Secretary, another Eagle Scout, as well as Rick Perry, who was behind Trump on stage there, also an Eagle Scout. But yes, Jeff Sessions was left out of that meeting, similar, as you note, to Sean Spicer not meeting with the Pope. So certainly Donald Trump is annoyed with Jeff Sessions. And going out and publicly shaming his own attorney general, this is not normal. Between that and talking about confirming a CIA covert operation while on Twitter, you know, and that Boy Scout speech just overall was very strange. It was not a normal kind of speech, certainly not one you're delivering to adolescent boys trying to, you know, inspire hope and promise for what's going to come for their futures.
Well, as others have pointed out, you know, presidents have spoken there for 80 years and avoided partisan politics. Trump went right at Obamacare, kill it. Hillary Clinton, he mentioned his opponents, his, you know, Obama. How will this play out, especially when he has another big appearance tonight in Youngstown, Ohio?
It seems like he was just getting warmed up. He sort of treated that Boy Scout speech like it was a campaign event. He seemed to feed off the adulation of the crowd and the whoops and the hollers. He really likes that feeling. You could see him go and meander off script in the same kinds of ways that he did during the campaign. So I assume that you're going to see a lot more of those same kinds of political attacks. The irony of that Boy Scout speech is that he opened it saying nobody wants to hear politics at the Boy Scouts, right? And then he went on to deliver a hotly political speech.
Well, some who were there said there might have been some booze as well. I mean, he
They were mixed in.
Yeah, so he's kind of in effect writing off the fact that any Democrats might have kids who are Boy Scouts.
Well, there's that. You know, I mean, there are some councils of the Boy Scouts that have put out opposing statements to the Boy Scouts today, which said that they, you know, the Boy Scouts of America put out a statement saying that they're a nonpartisan group and did not want that. Some of the councils actually put out statements rejecting President Trump's speech.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
The House of Representatives votes today on new sanctions aimed at punishing Russia for its interference in last year's election. And while the focus is on Russia, the bill also includes new sanctions against Iran. This comes at a crucial time for diplomacy between the two countries as President Trump reviews his administration's policy on Iran. Now, during the campaign, Trump then said he would cancel the nuclear deal Iran struck under President Obama. But earlier this month, the president again agreed to recertify that deal. However, now the administration is once again considering its options. So for more on this, we're joined by Andrew Exum, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East Policy under President Obama. He's now a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And Andrew, the magazine Foreign Policy last week reported that President Trump may have assigned White House staffers to make the case for withholding certification of the deal at the end of the next 90-day review period. So what do you make of that?
Well, I think one of the worries here is that even though there's broad consensus within the United States government that Iran is meeting the conditions of the deal, even if it's never stopped being a malign actor more broadly in the region, that Trump just doesn't buy it. He's got some very prominent Iran hawks within his National Security Council and within his broader personal staff, and he seems as if he has tasked them with undermining the deal, or at least thinking about it in a way much more critically than his Department of State or his Department of Defense.
Right. So before we talk about the challenges posed by the Trump administration on Iran, let me just sort of dive into the reasons why, as you say, those Iran hawks in the Trump administration feel the way they do. I mean, for example, the Trump administration has accused Iran of violating the spirit of the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, what exactly do they mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the broader frustration with the Iran nuclear deal, and I would share this frustration to a certain degree, is that it didn't stop Iran from being a malign actor. I think that in the euphoria that followed the Iran nuclear deal, there was some hope within the U.S. administration, perhaps with Secretary Kerry, perhaps with others, that the Iran nuclear deal might be the basis for something more, might be the basis for bringing Iran in from the cold. And I think that a lot of the skeptics of Iran and a lot of skeptics of the Obama administration's policy towards Iran seized on that optimism as naive. There's an argument to be made that the United States should be more aggressive against Iran. The Iran nuclear deal, by the admission of the last administration, does nothing about the buildup of conventional arms in Iran, does nothing about Iran's support to proxies in places like Iraq and Yemen. The problem is where the United States has been most successful in the Middle East has been working as a part of broad coalitions. That's been the case in the fight against the Islamic State, where the United States is part of a military coalition with 29 other nations and has been very successful. And it's also the case of Iran's nuclear program, where the United States entered into negotiations with Iran with the backing of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany, plus the European Union. And so the danger is if the United States is seen as being the one to undermine the nuclear deal, then what that does is that Iran isn't going to be the state that's looked at as being a rogue state by the international community. It's going to be the United States. And that means that multilateral diplomacy, which achieved a lot, will no longer be on the table. And it suddenly you get into a position where you have to escalate to some sort of military strike if you want to do something about an Iranian nuclear program.
I mean, there are some who wonder if that's exactly what the Iran hawks in the administration want.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the case. A lot of the people who were very critical of the deal that the United States and its international partners brokered with the Iranians, they didn't really have an alternative, you know, short of some sort of military strike. Well, there's huge risk to the United States there, right? those 6,000 or so U.S. troops that are in Iraq, for example, they have only had to fight the Islamic State, and they've had some success doing so. If they were to then have to worry about Iranian-backed militias, well, we unfortunately know exactly what that looks like, given how many hundreds of U.S. soldiers were killed by Iranian proxies during the Iraq War from 2003 until 2010.
Right. And just to reiterate what you wrote in The Atlantic, the Trump administration's efforts to perhaps not recertify the Iran deal is over the objections of the Department of State and the Defense Department. And, I mean, in the article, you say that to do so would be a mistake of epic proportions.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Unfortunately, I think it reflects a real distrust that this president has in the institutions that he now leads. There's a real chance that simply because this president is just on a different page or is getting inputs from people outside the intelligence community, outside the departments of energy and state and defense, that he may end up taking rash actions which weaken the United States and our standing abroad.
Andrew Exum is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Middle East Policy under President Barack Obama. He's now a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you so much for having me.
50 years ago this summer, race riots broke out in many American inner cities. In the aftermath, then-President Lyndon Johnson appointed a commission to figure out why. It was called the Kerner Commission, and its report came to a startling and controversial conclusion. To quote, "Our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." Last year, Lester Graham from Here and Now contributor Michigan Radio told us why the Kerner Commission's recommendations were ignored and why in an age of Black Lives Matter, the report's lessons still resonate. Today, we revisit Lester's story and a warning. It contains language that may upset some listeners.
It was called the Long Hot Summer. 1967 saw dozens of racial uprisings in cities such as Newark, Boston, and Detroit. And Detroit's was the worst. 43 people were killed and more than 1,000 injured, most of them black. Thousands of National Guard troops and police were already in the streets. The mayor and the governor wanted more help. President Lyndon Johnson sent in 5,000 U.S. Army troops.
I take this action with the greatest regret and only because of the clear, the unmistakable, and the undisputed evidence that Governor Romney of Michigan and the local officials in Detroit have been unable to bring the situation under control.
Before the fires in Detroit were out, Johnson spoke to the nation again. He was appointing an 11-member advisory commission on civil disorders. It was chaired by then-Illinois Governor Otto Kerner and became known as the Kerner Commission.
The commission will investigate the origins of the recent disorders in our cities. It will make recommendations to me, to the Congress, to the state governors, and to the mayors for measures to prevent or contain such disasters in the future.
The president wanted to know why. Why did these uprisings happen? Within 7 months, the Kerner Commission had an answer. Nathaniel R. Jones was assistant general counsel for the commission.
One of the conclusions of the Kerner report was that white racism was the cause of the upsets and the uprisings that we had. In fact, the report stated that white society created it, perpetuates it, and sustains it.
In other words, white racism, white attitudes were the underlying reasons for racial unrest in the cities. Many white politicians and news media vehemently resisted that finding. Detroit had been seen by the nation as a model of race relations. Blacks were getting jobs in Detroit that simply were not available to people of color in much of the rest of the country. Overlooked was the fact that Detroit African Americans often were given the hardest and dirtiest jobs, often were passed up for promotions, and generally made less money. Housing was inferior. Unemployment among people of color was higher. Relationships with police were strained.
The commission said in its report that there was a combination of complex social, psychological, poverty problems all tangled up, which create this feeling on the part of people that they can't trust authority. And that was true as a lead into what happened in the 60s, and it's true now.
The report's most quoted conclusion read, "Our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal." Joe T. Darden is a professor at Michigan State University and co-author of a book on the 1967 Detroit riots. He says the Kerner Report challenged whites' attitudes about blacks, and he says that made President Johnson worry it would damage the Democrats' chance to keep the White House. So publicly, Johnson barely acknowledged the report.
The report put the responsibility for all of this stuff on white society and white institutions. That, I think, was a surprise to some white Americans, and I think that that was part of the reason he was very careful not to upset the large segment of white society. That was why I think that it happened like that.
Another factor in President Johnson's silence on the Kerner Report was his own ego. He felt the report ignored the accomplishments of his Great Society programs. But in a 1969 interview for the LBJ Library, Commission Chair Otto Kerner said praising Johnson's work would give the report a political flavor the commission members did not want. Kerner said Johnson privately told him he was working quietly to implement Kerner Report recommendations.
He says, you know, we've been trying to do these things that you recommended in the report. And as you know, Congress is not very acceptable to the things that I proposed. But he said, I want you to know that I have my the members of the cabinet, the White House staff people are still trying to have accepted those things I've already recommended.
But that's not what Johnson told one of his political buddies. A phone call between Johnson and Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley reveals Johnson had problems with the report. By then, Johnson had announced he would not seek another term as president, but his former attorney general, Robert F. Kennedy, was running, and Kennedy pushed the Kerner Report recommendations. Johnson also felt the commission's vice chair, New York Mayor John Lindsay, had pushed the commission too far.
And Bobby just gave me hell today for not carrying out the Kerner Commission study. Well, I didn't realize when I appointed Kerner that this son of a bitch from New York, Lindsay, would take charge. He did take charge, and he recommended I hire 2.5 million people on federal payroll. And I just, I've not wanted to reflect on Kerner and criticize the commission. At the same time, I couldn't embrace it because I've got a budget.
That Johnson budget had doubled because of the Vietnam War. Nearly five decades later, that report by the Kerner Commission is still considered one of the most insightful documents on race relations and remedies for discrimination to ever be published by the government. Michigan State University professor Joe T. Darden says the cost of ignoring the Kerner Report set opportunities for African Americans back decades.
That would have eliminated this separation where you have central city, suburb, white, suburb, black, central city, white affluent, black poverty. That would have prevented that. They didn't take that alternative. What the Kerner Commission really wanted the society to do.
Some scholars argue that Americans, white Americans, have not learned the lesson of the 1960s uprisings or the recommendations to correct the problems.
In the wake of the Kerner Report, we have created two societies that are deeply unequal. That is a fact.
Heather Ann Thompson is a professor at the University of Michigan and wrote the book, Who's Detroit?
The inequality, income inequality, racial inequality, suburban city inequality, job inequality, we could just go on and on and on, is far worse. And that is a deeply racialized inequality. So we've done that. The question remains, what do we do next?
Resentment surrounding issues of race has been building over those decades. Resentment among blacks who still find themselves at the bottom of the economic ladder, and resentment among whites who've been knocked down a rung or two. Paul Lee is a Detroit historian who's written on the 1967 uprising in Detroit. He says things are not any better today than they were in the 1960s, and perhaps worse. He says the protests we've seen in the last couple of years are revealing.
Our situation, that is the situation of African Americans in Detroit and throughout the country, I think is much more precarious than it's been perhaps in a century.
The reason, says Lee, is the shaky economic underpinnings of black neighborhoods. Few blacks own their own homes, a significant factor in building wealth. The relatively few middle-class black families who could afford it later followed white families to the suburbs. With them went black businesses. The little economic power African Americans had slipped away. But there was optimism, because in some cities, political power grew for black Americans. Black mayors and city council members were elected. But Paul Lee says political power is limited.
While I think that black political power is important, I think that if there's no economic foundation, then black power is relatively meaningless. Black political power is relatively meaningless.
The shift from black power in the 1960s to today's Black Lives Matter seems to be slipping from a demand to have a seat at the table to the request, please don't kill us. But Black Lives Matter isn't the only protest movement. In Detroit, dating back to at least the takeover by an emergency manager and then bankruptcy, new groups have been raising their voices in and around the city. There are protests for economic inclusion, against foreclosures and water shutoffs, and against police brutality.
No racist police! No racist police!
We're skeptical of government because government isn't serving us.
Reverend Charles Williams II is the president of the Michigan chapter of National Action Network. He says people are frustrated that in many ways life in Detroit is worse now than it was in 1967.
As we see our struggle today, we see that some of those same issues are ahead of us. And so this is the reason why we must continue to organize, and it's the reason why we continue to organize.
Heather Ann Thompson, the University of Michigan professor, says policymakers today largely are ignoring issues in the same way policymakers ignored them in the 1960s.
The good news is that we now, I think, are really hearing from those people who have suffered this very directly. And that's why Ferguson has blown up. And that's why Baltimore has exploded. And that's why people across cities in America or cities across America are speaking out and saying, no, we need a different civil rights movement, right? We need a different moment of change.
And to be effective, that change will have to negotiate opportunities for African Americans to be included in both political and economic power, just as the Kerner Report recommended nearly five decades ago. For Here and Now, I'm Lester Graham.
And Bill McGraw from Bridge Magazine helped with the reporting on this story. We also had production assistance from the Oral History Project at the Lyndon Baines Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The Federal Reserve kicked off its two-day policy meeting today. The Fed isn't expected to change interest rates after raising them last month for the third time since December. Meanwhile, pop quiz for you all. Do you really know what the Fed actually does? Don't be shy to admit the truth if you don't, because a new survey from WalletHub finds that there is a lot of confusion about the function the Fed serves. But nevertheless, one in seven Americans thinks it should be abolished anyway. Well, Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule, and he's with us now from New York. Hello, Ali.
Hey, Magna.
Okay, so 16% of people think the Fed determines our credit scores, which it does not. What do you make of this mass confusion about the Federal Reserve?
Look, there is a lot of confusion. I spent a lot of time trying to explain it. Let me try again. The Fed, think about it as a car that has no steering and no, just has a gas pedal and a brake. And the car is the economy. So if the Fed wants to speed the economy up, it lowers interest rates. That makes it cheaper to borrow, so people borrow more and they spend more. If the Fed wants to cool the economy down, it taps the brakes by increasing interest rates, which makes it more expensive to borrow money and people spend less. So that's what it is. It's got a gas pedal and it's got brakes. It tries to help the economy speed up or slow down as necessary.
Right. So, but given the thing that it's helping is the economy, one would hope that we would all understand what it does little better. Do you think it matters that most people don't really get it?
No, I don't really, unless it gets to a point where the government wants to abolish the Fed. And there have been calls for that. Ron Paul used to be very big on that. Rand Paul is now. You know, Ben Carson has been critical of the Fed. So has Donald Trump. The bottom line is every country, most major economies have a central bank of some sort. The Fed is America's version of the central bank, and it operates very similarly to these other banks. They have a few tools in their box to try and help out the economy. But real fiscal policy comes from the government. So the Fed is not in place of the government, which increases taxes and lowers taxes and does things like that. This is monetary policy. It's important, but it's in the background. It's not very sexy.
Well, it's interesting, though, because from the time of the Fed's birth, the debate over monetary policy and sovereignty of the United
yep.
States has been with us for sure. But bringing us back to the present day here, the president has said that he will replace Fed Chair Janet Yellen when her term
yep.
ends next year. What do you expect there?
Yeah, so a lot of people are talking about Gary Cohn, the president's chief economic advisor, as a likely candidate, but there are others. The campaign, during the campaign, President Trump sort of accused Janet Yellen of trying to help President Obama by keeping interest rates low. As you know, Magna, that's also an old saw. All presidents accuse the Fed of doing something that favors the other one. There's no particular truth in that. The Fed is an independent body, but the members, the governors, are appointed by the president for a 10-year term, like the FBI. It's meant to not coincide with presidential terms, so as to not be political. There's some real criticism that the Federal Reserve serves the interest of the wealthy more. Keeping interest rates low is something that rich people benefited more than poor people or people who depend on a fixed income did. So there are valid conversations to have around the Fed, but they generally don't reach the level of eliminating it versus keeping it.
Yeah. Now, and if the president did replace Janet Yellen with Gary Cohn, he'd be the first non-economist to serve as Fed chair in something like 40 years.
Yeah, and it's yeah. a lot of important economic work that the Fed does, so it's worth thinking about that.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshian Rule. Thank you.
President Trump will hold a rally in Youngstown, Ohio tonight. On the campaign trail, he made promises like renegotiating trade deals, bringing back mining and factory jobs, and that resonated with this old steel town. So how do residents feel 6 months in? Let's talk to two. First, Bertram D'Souza, a columnist with the local paper The Vindicator. Bertram, what do you think Youngstown needs to hear from the president tonight?
I find it odd because it was the Trump-Pence campaign that made the announcement of the visit. So it makes me wonder whether there are going to be any policy initiatives announced or whether this is just going to be Donald Trump needing to, you know, hear his supporters tell him that he still walks on water and they all love him.
Well, and it may be obvious to people by now that you have been a critic of the president, but maybe he's coming because, you know, he did so well in Trumbull County in particular. I mean, this is a place that voted
yeah, but,
for...
But the question is, coming for what? Shortly after he was sworn in, the third shift at General Motors Lordstown Assembly Plant was eliminated. And you have direct jobs plus associated jobs with providers. More than 1,000 have been lost. And yet, when the president ran, he talked about the auto industry and how he was going to force the American auto manufacturers to not only expand their plants and to create jobs in America, but he was going to demand that they bring back the jobs they sent overseas.
Well, what about some of the president's other promises? There were promises on trade, promises on infrastructure that were supposed to bring back blue-collar jobs in the area.
All of those promises resonated. Okay, on trade, absolutely. You know, the president said that he was going to level the playing field, that he was going to go after China on currency manipulation, that he was going to get rid of NAFTA and all the other kinds of trade agreements because they were so unfair to American workers. Now, this is a very long-standing blue-collar region where steel was king for a long time. We are coming up to the 40th anniversary in September of what we call Black Monday, where a major steel mill shut down, 5,000 jobs were eliminated, and that was the beginning of the end of steel production in the Mahoning Valley. And a lot of the workers here blame foreign competition. And so when Donald Trump said, I'm going to come in here and I am going to put America first, I'm going to make America great again, that message resonated. And yet we're sitting here, the steel mills have not reopened, and I never believed they would reopen. Even if a new steel mill is opened in the Mahoning Valley, we had one several years ago. It's a French company called Vallourec. Its highest employment is 400. We lost 50,000 direct and indirect steel-related jobs when the mills closed. At one time in the history of the GM Lordstown plant, we had 15,000 workers out there. Today we have 4,000. It's called automation.
Well, and others agree with you that people need to be retrained. Don't go back to manufacturing and steel production and mining. That's not going to come back.
Sure.
Talk about health care. According to state data, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare's Medicaid expansion gave health care to over 20,000 people in Mahoning County.
Yes.
Have you seen people, because we've been seeing this, you know, on a national level, people who, first of all, didn't really understand that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare were the same
right.
thing. But people also who supported Donald Trump now realizing that the plans that have been put on the table by Republicans would cut back on their coverage.
The problem is that a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump were already on Medicare, which is a government health program, which, you know, which I found ironic. But a lot of people also needed Medicaid, especially with the expansion. And the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, made it very, very clear that Medicaid expansion was absolutely necessary. And they did. They expanded it. 700,000 additional people were put on Medicaid. In the midst of an opioid epidemic that has hit regions like ours very, very hard. And these are people who are on Medicaid, who are getting treatment, who are getting, you know, counseling. And once they realized what sort of getting rid of Obamacare was going to do to them, those people are now beginning to say, hold on a minute. We supported Donald Trump when he said he was going to have affordable medical care for everyone in America. And that's not what the Republicans have produced and what Donald Trump is supporting. So, yes, he's going to have to answer those questions.
That's Bertram D'Souza, columnist with the local Youngstown paper, The Vindicator. Bertram, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's now bring in someone who is going to attend the rally as a Trump supporter. Paula Muir of nearby Mineral Ridge, Ohio, is a part-time college instructor, former hospital administrator. She was a lifelong Democrat but switched parties for Donald Trump and, in fact, now volunteers at the Republican headquarters. Paula, do you still have the same fervor?
I do.
Why is that?
Because I personally believe that he is straight, honest, not a lifelong politician. He loves our country. He loves our veterans. He loves God. And he feels everyone that's able to work should be working.
Well, let me pick up on something you said. You love his honesty. And that's what we hear from Trump supporters. They love that he tells it like it is. But as you know, there have been a lot of calculations about Donald Trump's honesty. Politico, for instance, points out that 70% of candidate Donald Trump statements that PolitiFact checked during the campaign were false. Only 4% were completely true. Recently, we've had, you know, major publications that are not considered left-leaning, Time Magazine or People Magazine, talking about how the Trump family, in fact, doesn't tell the truth. Doesn't that concern you?
No, it does not. Listen, I could say something, but there's no fact-checking for me. And honestly, I've read articles where the fact-checking has been incorrect.
Okay, well, let's go on to some of the promises that the president
made.
You talked about jobs.
Yes.
And as we just heard, there are actually fewer jobs in your area than 4 years ago. Are you concerned about that?
I am concerned about that. Most of us that grew up in the 60s and 70s, our parents or our fathers at least worked in the steel industry. One of the things, I don't know if the steel industry will ever come back to our area, but there are other jobs. We need skilled laborers.
Healthcare. You're a hospital administrator.
Yes.
The Republicans have not been able to put forth a plan after 7 years.
Correct.
Yeah.
It needs repealed. It really needs repaired. You know, there are so many portions of it that has skyrocketed prices. It helped a lot of people, the Affordable Care Act, but it hurt a lot of people. I had a lot of friends that were working with health care who lost it because their employers could no longer afford it.
Yeah. Well, but this is what Democrats said. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton during the campaign famously said Obamacare is crazy. You know, it needs to be fixed. They did say that it needs to be fixed.
Right. But they're not on the same page.
Well, they're not being invited. They weren't asked to participate.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with you on that.
Okay.
But are Republicans, so many of them that were for repealing and replacing or repairing it, because their constituents are so afraid of what it's going to hurt them, that they're now backing off and they don't want to do anything about it either.
Right.
Honestly, I don't know what the answer is, other than they need to check their egos at the door and come in and look at what's best for us.
Are you at all concerned about what we're hearing today and in the past couple of days? Presidents have used their office as a bully pulpit.
Yes.
Historically. But this president, some say, is bullying. That, for instance, he's got an attorney general that he's tearing apart on Twitter. I mean, does that bother you, that kind of language, calling somebody weak and beleaguered when they work for you?
I don't always agree with his tactics. I personally feel that the fact that he is constantly under attack, that puts you in that same mode. I'm not saying that's right because I don't believe in bullying either. I like the fact that he uses other media to share with us what's going on,
mm-hmm.
but I can't say that I 100% agree with his tactics.
Yeah.
And I don't think you'll find any Trump supporter that 100% agrees with some of the things that he has said or done.
That's Paula Meara of Mineral Ridge, Ohio, a lifelong Democrat who became a Republican to vote for Donald Trump and is going to go to that rally tonight. Paula, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And, of course, you just gave a shout out there. If you are a Trump supporter who agrees 100% with all of his tactics, let us hear from you as well.
A summer hike up to a 13,000-foot alpine meadow can be exhilarating. But what if you decided to live at that altitude for the rest of your life? Lower oxygen levels, frigid temperatures, and sparse vegetation would make it tough. Archaeologists know hunter-gatherers traversed highland areas thousands of years ago, but presumed they also had to spend time in lowland areas in order to survive. But now that idea is being challenged by a team of researchers at the University of Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports.
Archaeologist Randy Haas routinely travels to the Andean Plateau in Peru, and as soon as he arrives, he's reminded why some of his colleagues are reluctant to believe his hypothesis that hunter-gatherers lived here at high altitudes year-round.
I've seen people get off the plane in Juliaca and just fall over, and people will rush out with oxygen tanks because of the lack of oxygen.
Not to mention, it's cold.
If you don't have fancy down jackets and sleeping bags, it's very difficult to keep warm. There are not a lot of trees up there, not a lot of fuel to burn at this high elevation.
Haas says the harsh environs make it tough to grow food. All these things combined make it a challenging place to live, which explains why this high elevation region was one of the last frontiers for human settlement.
And for a lot of scholars, it was believed that it wasn't really until you had food production, that's what made permanent habitation of these landscapes possible.
We know that between 3,000 and 5,000 years ago, agricultural communities emerged in the alpine valleys of the Andes. The descendants of these early farmers still successfully work the land today. If you've ever eaten quinoa, it was likely grown in this region of Peru. But few people had studied the hunter-gatherers who lived here. Haas saw an opportunity to help fill a gap in the historical understanding of how humans came to settle at high elevations.
And this one particular site, Soroma Cayapata, we knew about from surface remains, scatters of flake stone tools on the surface.
That was a pretty good indicator that evidence of hunter-gatherers might be buried underground at Soro 2, But first, he had to meet with the local community to get their blessing to dig right in the middle of their barley field.
What I'd hoped to find at the time were just maybe some house features, hearths. But what I didn't expect to find and what we ended up coming across was a burial assemblage, 16 human individuals in burial pits.
He knew he'd hit the jackpot, but he was nervous. Nervous how the local community would respond to the disturbance of their ancient ancestors' remains. But he says they too were intrigued by the discovery and encouraged him to proceed.
And you can see each one of these bags have different labels on them.
Haas handles fragments of 7,000-year-old bones that now sit on his desk at the University of Wyoming, where he's wrapping up a year-long fellowship. When he first arrived, he shared his find with his colleague Melissa Murphy, an anthropologist who also studies human evolution in the highlands of Peru. And she immediately knew Haas was going to make an important contribution to the understanding of the occupation of the Andes.
Hunter-gatherers and foragers, they don't bury their dead in cemeteries. There's not going to be large sample sizes.
Since hunter-gatherers were mobile, they didn't build large structures or accumulate stuff, which means they left behind fewer clues. So to find a body, let alone 16, is a big deal.
Because there are important transitions that we move from being a hunter-gatherer forager to being a settled pastoralist or a settled agriculturalist. And what happens? How does that come about? And when do humans occupy these higher elevations?
Haas's discovery offered a solid answer to Murphy's questions for several reasons.
If this was a temporary camp monitored from a low elevation base camp, then the old and infirm wouldn't have been coming along. Young children probably would have been left behind. And it turns out that our burial assemblage has two children who are somewhere between ages 4 to 6 years old. We have at least one man who's over 50. We have men and women. And so this was another line of evidence that seemed to suggest that there was a whole population living up here long term.
And the chemical makeup of the bones has a story to tell, too. Haas got help from some graduate students who tested the isotopes in the bones. Signature ratios of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen revealed the altitude where the water and food these folks consumed was sourced.
It was really amazing to see that they fell into the high altitude precipitation values for oxygen. And I was like, these people live there.
Ioana Stefanescu, one of the graduate students, was the first person to see the results.
I remember I put my laptop in my purse and I was like running. I couldn't wait to tell them.
This groundbreaking discovery earned Haas and his team a place in the July issue of Royal Society Open Science, a journal that requires an arduous review of an article before it's published. Haas's next big question is, how did the Peruvian hunter-gatherers do it? He says there's already an important clue. All of the bodies exhibited evidence of cranial modification or head shaping. Haas believes the group strapped boards to their babies' heads to shape their skulls as a way of showing a cultural connection.
It's telling us something more about the importance of community in not only surviving, but thriving in adverse conditions.
Haas will join the archaeology department at the University of California, Davis this fall, where he plans to pursue his research. For Here and Now, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.